greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on destroyed arguments when we come back. You know, over the past century, we Americans who were once independent, capable, and able to manage our own financial, medical, and legal affairs have now been reduced to dependence, to incompetence, incapacity, and we've been made wards of these powerful commercial, financial, medical, and legal corporations, cartels, and bureaucratic institutions of our modern industrial society. And we've been taught to rely upon these paid professionals like bankers to manage our financial affairs, doctors to manage and treat our health problems, and lawyers to direct our business and legal affairs instead of relying upon our own good common sense. Now, that's why I contend that it's time that we Americans who were once able to catch our own fish learn once again how to fish instead of being fed by these paid professionals. Regaining our power of attorney is the single most important step in regaining our capacity, our rights, our liberties, and our duties. Now, if you'd like to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you write for my free general law CD package? That's the place to begin. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. That's right, it's free of charge. Just call the law school and ask for it. The number's 417-273-4967 to order yours. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Then click on to the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember the phone number, 417-273-4967, or the webpage, georgegordon.org. All right, we've been talking about destroyed arguments. Now, the concept originated with Larry Beecraft, so I went through a number of these destroyed arguments from Larry Beecraft's brief, which is entitled Destroyed Arguments. You can get a copy of this brief from his website. Just go to http://fly2as.com. I think it's .com. Let me look it up here. Nope, it's .net. http://fly. That's F-L-Y dot highway. Oh, I said it was H-Y. It isn't. It's H-I-W-A-A-Y. H-I-W-A-A-Y. The odd thing about highway there is that it's spelled with two A's. .net. And get a copy, and he'll have all of the cases that are cited in the list there. Each one of these destroyed arguments has been researched out by Larry. Larry, by the way, is a licensed, bona fide attorney. He's been to law school. He knows how to do legal research. I told you where I met him and told you about our relationship. Goes back 20 or 25 years now. He's getting to be an old man. I'm sure that he's 70 years old. I'm pushing 70. So he's been around the block a few times, knows what he's talking about. And here in the Patriot Movement, there have been so many ideas floated and so many people have gone to prison making these arguments that have lost in court. Now, if an argument is lost in court, you don't need to make it, because if you use it, you're going to lose too. So the purpose behind these destroyed arguments is to give you the insight so that you can see, well, that's already been tried. The guy that did it lost and went to prison. And if you do that, you're going to lose and go to prison too. So get off of these destroyed arguments. We're up to number 21. The law is not copyrighted. Now, there's an argument floating around the freedom movement that the law is copyrighted. That's nonsense. The law is owned by the public and it cannot be copyrighted. Back in 1834, two reporters for the U.S. Supreme Court got involved in a legal battle over the cases of the Supreme Court. In Wheaton v. Peters, cited at 8 Peters 591, decided in 1834, the Supreme Court declared that no reporter can have any copyright in the written opinions delivered by this court. Decisions of the courts belong to the public and nobody can copyright those decisions. Now, West Publishing Company, one of the largest publishers of legal materials, knows that it cannot copyright cases. It places in its electronic versions of the cases the following caveat. It says, copyright, West Group, 1998, no claim to original U.S. government work. Now, but what about statutes? Now, this is addressed in 17 U.S.C. section 105, subject matter of copyright, United States government work. Quote, copyright protection under this title is not available for any work of the United States government, but the United States government is not precluded from receiving and holding copyrights transferred to it by assignment, bequest, or otherwise. Those arguing that the law is copyrighted are wrong. But this argument is an important part of the argument for those who promote the grand theory that we are still subjects of the British Crown under the apparent contention that the King or Queen Elizabeth of England today owns the law. Now, as I've shown you above, public documents belong to the public and they cannot be copyrighted. When any court decides any case, anyone may go and obtain a copy of that decision. I can get any decision. You can, and West Publishing can. I may, and you may, and West Publishing does publish those cases. I could start my own company publishing these cases and making them available to whoever would buy them. However, I doubt that I'd stay in business very long against West. And that's because West has hundreds of people employed by that company who get these cases, read them, and make little head notes. They make these head notes about various legal points in the cases. Then, West Publishing publishes these cases in nicely bound books. It then takes the head notes that it generates for these cases and puts them into legal encyclopedias, which group all of the head notes of all of the cases in specific categories. Using West studying and finding law has been made a lot easier. West also has a competitor. It's called Lawyers Co-op. Now, the federal government publishes acts of Congress in a set of books called the Statutes at Large. Now, in large university libraries, you can find the Statutes at Large. However, the feds also publish the United States Code, which is simply stated, the statutes at large, which are organized in a more methodical fashion by way of titles, and you can find the true blue, but it is really red in color, U.S. Code, in many libraries. However, once the code, or since the code, is a public document, anybody can copy it. Now here, West and Lawyers Co-op are fierce competitors, with one publishing USCA and the other publishes USCS. Both of these publications contain accurate reprints of the various uncopyrightable sections and titles of these official U.S. government documents. However, West employs hundreds of people who read and categorize cases, and West puts summaries of many cases at the end of the sections of the U.S. Code. So when you engage in legal research, cases regarding a specific statute are there at your fingertips. Now, Lawyers Co-op does the same thing, and all of this other writing in these versions of the code was created by these companies, and this is the material which is copyrighted in these books. It's not the cases, it's their work, their headnotes. Now, I never use the official U.S. Code, and neither does anybody else. It just sits up there on the top shelf in your local law library gathering dust. And the reason for that is that nobody uses the official version because of the absence of the handy research materials like these case summaries and other references. So if I have a conspiracy case, I pulled USCIS, turn to Title 18, Section USC, Title 18, Section 371, and I start reading the very refined annotations at the end of the section, which quickly point you to the relevant cases decided by the Circuit Courts of Appeal and the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, it wasn't always this way. Years ago, the states officially published their own legal materials, cases and codes, and West was the competitor. Well, as time passed, West acquired dominant market share because its books were superior. Legislatures would appropriate funds for official case books, which were often large, expensive books with large print. So West published smaller books with smaller print, and its publications were obviously cheaper. Now, why would anyone buy from the state its publication of the cases when, for probably the same price or less, you could buy from West its regional reporter containing cases not only from your state but from several states? In short, free enterprise beat the socks off of government. And today, many states just let West do all of the publishing of cases for them. Of course, anyone could compete against West. It's an open marketplace. It's just that West Publishing probably produces the best product, and it's hard to compete. But West is not fearful of copyright infringement from the public at large. I violate the copyright laws every time I go to the law library, and so does everybody else. The law schools are perhaps the biggest violators, and law students copy away at copyrighted materials. West really doesn't care. In fact, West wants everybody using its products. West Publishing does fear, however, another competitor, a competitor like Lexis, for instance. Lexis, back in the early 1980s, started putting cases on computer, but it used West's page numbers from its case volumes, and West sued and won against Lexis for infringement, the court holding that the only thing that West could copyright were its own page numbers from its books as well as the headnotes that it wrote for the cases. And as a result, West and Lexis formed a partnership, and now cases are on compact disc. Formerly, to buy all of West's Supreme Court Reporter, it would have cost you several thousand dollars. Now, two compact discs with all Supreme Court cases can be bought for $200. Private enterprise has thus run circles around government. So there's the story on the copyright. The government work that comes out is not copyrightable. In fact, if you take a look at the copyright statutes, you can actually use for educational purposes copyright material. I do here quite often. But you can't use it for sale. You can't go copy something from somebody and then take it out and sell it. It's got to be used in connection with education. So college professors and schools, etc., that copy short excerpts off of people's books and etc. and use it for teaching aids and so on is perfectly acceptable, and it's an exception to the copyright laws. And there are a number of those exceptions. So the concept here that the laws and cases of the United States are copyrighted and belong to Queen Elizabeth is not so. It's another one of those destroyed arguments. Now, number 22 is called the straw man site draft argument. You've probably heard the straw man and site drafts and the UCC. And the first time I heard this was from a fellow who was an engineer. Nice enough guy. He's an old guy. And he was running around talking about this UCC and 1-207, and it's got pretty popular in patriot circles around the country, and I see things like this quite often, and I just look at it and shake my head and laugh and go about my business. It's never been my thing in life to correct people's errors. My position in life is that it is not my duty to protect every fool from his folly. Over the years, I've made enough mistakes of my own, and then from my own experience, I've learned from them. Oftentimes, if I can, I will learn from other people's experience. I got to tell you a little story here. A guy by the name of Irwin Schiff. Now, Irwin Schiff has been in the tax protest movement for as long as I can remember. He was here before I got on the scene, and hell, he may be here long after I'm dead and buried. But I remember first meeting Irwin Schiff in Marin County, California, back in the 1980s. We were on the lecture circuit together, and he'd given a lecture to some group. I forgot the group or what we were talking about now, but I had lunch with him and chit-chatted with him, and he filled me in, and I met people, you know, like A.J. Porth. And A.J. Porth went to prison. Irwin Schiff has been to prison. George Gordon hasn't been to prison yet, but that's not a guarantee that I won't. You know, all of the apostles, Peter, Paul, James, and John, they all went to prison. Paul went to prison. Jesus didn't go to prison. They killed him for sedition and treason. They gave him the capital punishment. So you need to understand that throughout biblical history and throughout biblical times, you know, the people who have been working for the God of Abraham, the guys that go out and try to teach the law of God, Moses himself, have often been crosswise with the law. They have been on the lam. They have been executed. They have been jailed. They've been tortured and beaten. So don't think that because somebody's been to prison or has been to jail that he's on the wrong side. In fact, I would come to the conclusion that if you haven't been to jail, if you haven't been tried in the fire, you probably haven't lived yet. You probably don't know a hell of a lot about what you're talking about. Well, I got to know Irwin Schiff pretty well, and Irwin sat down one day over lunch, and he explained to me his thesis, his theory, his beliefs concerning the income tax. And I can remember at the time, I thought, well, if this is true, that's all well and good, but it just doesn't seem to me that that's 100% correct. So here's what I want to show you about destroyed arguments. Arguments that are used in the Patriot movement oftentimes are true. I mean, they've got real legal significance. There are real cases that support these ideas and theories. And then lay people get hold of those real cases and real ideas and real issues of law, and then they add to them or subtract from them or twist them and turn them and rewrite them and work them over until they become unrecognizable as a useful argument to use in court. So I'm going to break in on my thought over Irwin Schiff, and I'm going to show you a little example of that. There's a valid legal defense called the Garner defense, and it has to do with the Fifth Amendment. Now, this guy Garner was a gambler, and he had been convicted and jailed for gambling. He went to prison, served his time, and came out, and the IRS said, "Mr. Garner, we want you to file tax returns and pay us taxes on all of those illegal, ill-gotten gambling proceeds that you had." Well, Garner refused, and it went to trial. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court came back and said, "Well, Mr. Garner's right. The Fifth Amendment protects him from testifying against himself. So he doesn't have to give you this information." Well, I got started about 1978 in this Patriot movement. I happened to be at a Patriot meeting, and this guy got up there, and he told us about the Fifth Amendment tax return. About how when you fill out a tax return, you fill it out with Fifth Amendment on all the lines. I refused to answer on grounds of the Fifth Amendment. Well, the court got a hold of that issue, and they said, "No, you can't do that. You cannot fill out a tax return filed Fifth Amendment." And immediately that sounds like, well, why could Garner do it, and why can't I do it? And this is the thing that Larry Beecraft is pointing out here. Here's a valid defense called the Garner defense, been used for many, many years. I forgot what year it came down, but it's been on the books, you know, for 50 years, or maybe 75 or more. Kind of like Murdoch versus U.S., you know, called the reliance defense. But this Fifth Amendment defense has to be used within the terms and conditions that the Supreme Court set down. You can't refuse to fill out a tax return alleging that every answer that you give on the tax return is going to incriminate you. For instance, it calls for your name, your address, and your social security number. How is that going to incriminate you? Furthermore, you have to be in real and genuine fear of being prosecuted from the answer that you give. It has to have some substance or merit. You can't just say, well, I think the government might prosecute me. You've got to have an articulable fear that you can set out and say, well, I was convicted for gambling offenses. Now, I got to tell you a little adjunct to this. I had a student here in school one time, the only guy that's ever been here, that had a Garner Fifth Amendment defense. And he was from Wisconsin, and he had been jailed on a drug charge. He served his time, and he was out. He wasn't on parole or probation. And the IRS came against him and said, now fill out a tax return and pay us taxes on those illegal drug transactions you made. Well, he heard about our law school, and he came down here to the law school, and I listened to his story, and I put him through the strategy and procedure school, and I said, now, you're the only fellow that I've ever run into that has a legitimate Garner defense. And that's the appropriate defense in this case, and he applied it. And his case went to the Supreme Court also. Now, it actually went to the Circuit Court of Appeals, and then it was decided in his favor, and the Supreme Court, which later got an appeal from the government, declined to hear it, and so the Circuit Court of Appeals became the law of the land. And they simply upheld the Garner decision, is what the case boils down to, and the Supreme Court rejected it, said we're not going to hear it because Garner was applied, it's an appropriate defense, and of all the students that have gone through this school, that's the only time I've ever seen it. Now, let's go back to Irwin Schiff. Irwin Schiff has a very novel theory about income tax. That you're not a taxpayer, that you don't have any obligation to file tax returns because it's voluntary, that and a few other odds and ends. Now, the truth of the matter is, that's false. The income tax is voluntary, and you volunteered when you got your Social Security number. Furthermore, you work in commerce and you have income, and income is those checks and Federal Reserve notes, and there's 2,000 cases that identify what income is and all the arguments that have been raised. And I mentioned this earlier. There's three defenses to a tax charge. Murdoch reliance, Seeger religious re-exercise, and Aiken subjective good faith. And beyond that, it's a dead letter issue. Now, the Garner Fifth Amendment defense is certainly applicable, but only in those cases where you've been convicted for a crime and the answers that you would put on to a tax return would leave you open to further prosecution for drugs or gambling or something else. It's the only time that's going to work. Now, the reason I brought up Irwin Schiff is that one time my wife was reading the paper and she says, well, look at this. Irwin Schiff has been indicted for tax evasion. I don't know. This is 15, 20 years ago now. It's been quite a long time ago. So at that time, Schiff lived up in Connecticut, and I said, well, get him on the phone, sweet, and let me talk to him. So I got Irwin on the phone, and I said, well, Irwin, how's things going? We shot the breeze for a little bit, and I said, I see here you've been indicted. And I said, Irwin, why don't you come down here to school, and let me tell you what I know. And that way, you'll be smarter than I am, because you'll know everything that you know. Plus, I'm going to tell you everything that I know, and then you're going to know everything that you know, plus everything that I know, which will make you twice as smart as I am, because I won't know what you know. And he said, George, I'm up to my you-know-what and alligators, and I just haven't got the time. So I said, well, I understand how that goes, Irwin. So he hung up, and sometime later, my wife opened the paper, and she says, well, looky here, Irwin Schiff has been convicted. And I said, yeah, yeah. And a little while later, Irwin Schiff was sentenced to jail, and he went to jail, served his time. He got out, and I read about these events in the papers. And one day, my wife was reading the paper, and she says, well, looky here, Irwin Schiff has been indicted a second time. So I said, well, get him on the phone. And She did, and I talked to him for a little while, and how you doing, and things are going along pretty good. And so I said, well, listen, Irwin, why don't you come down here to school and let me tell you what I know? I don't know everything, but I'll tell you what I know, and coupled with what you know, you'll be twice as smart as I am, and maybe this will help you with your case. And he said, George, old buddy, I'm up to my you-know-what in alligators, and I just haven't got the time. I said, well, I understand. So we parted the ways, and some time later, my wife said, well, looky here, Irwin Schiff has been convicted, and a little while later, Irwin Schiff has been sentenced to jail, and so he's gone to jail again. And so a little time went by, and sure enough, one day my wife was reading the paper again, and Irwin Schiff had gotten out of prison, and some years had gone by, and she says, looky here, Irwin Schiff's been indicted. Now, this is the third time. Third time. And she said, do you want me to get him on the phone? And I said, no, it won't be necessary. And she asked me why, and I said, well, because he's up to his you-know-what in alligators, and he hasn't got time. I've already been through that drill with him. So there's no point in trying to teach an old dog new tricks. It's like trying to teach a pig to sing. It wastes your time, and it annoys the pig. Now, I noticed that he was convicted and sent to jail for the third time, and over the years, I can't tell you how many Irwin Schiff students have come to this school. It's in the hundreds. I mean, I'll just bet you several hundred have said to me, Mr. Gordon, I follow the Irwin Schiff plan, or I know about the Irwin Schiff plan, and what do you think of the Irwin Schiff plan, and blah, 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 blah. And so I'm pretty familiar with it, and I noticed the other day that Irwin Schiff has been indicted for the fourth time, and I saw the other day that he had made the insanity defense. I guess after you've been convicted three times, I guess insanity is the only possible defense left. I mean, after you've been told three times that you've lost, now, this is what Beecraft is pointing out. He says, you know, this Irwin Schiff program over here has been out for at least 20 years that I know of. He's gone to jail three times. If it was so good, how come he keeps going to jail? And I'll tell you why he keeps doing this. I got some numbers together the other day, and somebody said, do you know how much Irwin Schiff charges for his classes or his program? And I said, no. And they told me, and so we multiplied it out, and for the number of sales that he makes about $500,000 a year. Now, if you had a bogus, no good program that made you $500,000 a year, would you give it up? Just because it was untrue, didn't work, and you'd been to jail three times? I mean, you know, if it makes money, people are going to do it. And if people will buy into that kind of argument, why not? Now, I'm not into selling that, and I notice here that Beecraft isn't either. So when we come to this thing called straw man and sight drafts, I think it is as popular as, or maybe even more popular than, the Irwin Schiff program. I can't see that it makes any sense. I couldn't see that it made any sense when I first saw this some years back. I was invited out to Fresno, California, and a lady gave me two big, thick binders of this material. I went through it and read it, and I told this lady, I said, this is just nonsense. Doesn't have any legal merit, and if you go into court to argue this, or if you want to practice this, you can do that. I mean, if you want to claim that you've got a straw man over here, let me invite you to do this. Just look up the word straw man in Bouvier's Law Dictionary. It's a con man. It's a perjurer. It's a guy that's for sale who will get on the witness stand and lie for your side. It's what today we call the expert witness. That's what a straw man is. It's an expert witness. He'll just tell whatever lies you hire him to lie about. Now, why you'd want to call yourself a straw man, or why you'd want to say, well, I've got my straw man over here, is beyond me. But it's a very popular doctrine, a very popular position that patriots are making. It's about as bogus as a $3 bill. And the thing that makes it work and continue to work is that none of us like to be shown up to be wrong. I know that from time to time, you know, I will see something or somebody will point something out and say, hey, Gordon, you're wrong about this, and here's the answer to that riddle. And then I go look it up and I say, well, gee, I believed that with all of my heart. And now look, I find out that I made a mistake and I'm wrong. You know, it's the old story of, George has to eat crow. Well, I've eaten a lot of crow in my day. And I suppose I'll eat a lot more before I die. But it's better to eat crow than it is to go to prison and eat prison fare, I'll tell you that right now. So eat a little crow up front. Now I got to give you your mid-course reminder here, and we'll be back with number 22, the straw man and sight drafts, researched out by Larry B. Kraft when we come back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and we're open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Please be sure to order yours. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Now, most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Here's the story on straw man. There's a new theory floating around the movement which is absolutely wrong, absolutely crazy, yet it is promoted as the hot new solution. This new theory has its origins with a fellow named Roger Elvick. Elvick has been involved with some con jobs in the past. Roger Elvick was years ago into the idea of sending forms, like 1099 forms, to the IRS or its agents who stole your constitutional rights. This was a part of his redemption process. Back then, and if you wish to learn about what happened to one party who followed Elvick's advice, go to United States versus Wiley, 979 Fed 2nd, page 365 in the Fifth Circuit. Many others who followed Roger Elvick's advice also went to jail. He voluntarily made the decision to purchase and use Roger Elvick's redemption program, and he admitted that he did not pay any of the purported recipients any of the amounts reflected on the 1099 forms, because he knew he never paid the individuals. He could not have believed that the forms which he signed under penalty of perjury were in fact true and correct. And the evidence also established that the appellant acted corruptly in pursuing the retaliation scheme in violation of 26 U.S.C. Section 7212A. Now, I know Roger went to jail, and my recollection is that his incarceration arose from this activity. Now, while in prison, Roger Elvick developed this new argument. In essence, Elvick contends that everyone's birth certificate constitutes ownership in America Incorporated. And we all have stock in this corporation, which stock is represented by these birth certificates. Now, these similar arguments were rejected, and in 1986, the petitioner informs the court of his notorious rescission of his Social Security number and rescission of his birth certificate, which documents had previously made him a member of corporate America, the commune, converting him into a slave of the commune, subject to the regulation and control of the federal government. The fact that Dose has attempted to rescind his Social Security number and birth certificate by sworn affidavit is irrelevant. The big banks and other financial institutions regularly trade in these birth certificates, buying and selling them to others. Of course, according to this new argument, you can do the same thing. All right. Now, from here, the argument goes totally downhill and becomes even more bizarre. I know precisely what are the major features of this argument because I've read the course material and even viewed a videotape of one meeting where this issue was discussed. This contention is totally crazy. However, many people are studying this new issue and even issuing site drafts based upon this argument. But the promoters of this argument, like Elvick, Wally Peterson, Ron Nutt, Dave DeRemer, are really selling federal indictments. Now, you're free to buy into this scheme, but be ready to face criminal charges, the maximum term of imprisonment being 25 years. Here's some late-breaking news, an email regarding the law enforcement activity against the redemption advocates, dated January 11th, 2000. Now, I was just informed that a federal SWAT team, approximately 30, raided a farmhouse near the town of Everett, Michigan. And the raid started at 6 a.m. and lasted 4 hours until 10 a.m. They captured the occupants, made them sit and watch the proceedings. They were told nothing except that they were not under arrest. The raid was pursuant to a grand jury subpoena and contained a warrant for any and all items related to accepted for value, site drafts, and anything to do with the IRS and United States securities. I was told that there were 22 people on a list that were raided this a.m., and at least one of the occupants who was there was served a grand jury subpoena to appear and testify in February. No further information at this time. Be advised. So what's going to happen? Well, I bet that those who advocated using acceptance for value to refuse criminal process like an indictment or information will be charged with obstruction of justice, and they'll be tied into a giant conspiracy of those who hold or told others to send in drafts drawn on the U.S. Treasury. Now, this stupidity will just be another instance where the freedom movement will be held up to the press and the rest of America as a bunch of kooks and nuts and fruitcakes and dangerous ones at that. Now, there are certain very fundamental flaws within this argument, which are as follows. Now, I'm going to pause here and I'm going to interject a little something. 2 or 3 years ago, 4 or 5 people came down here from Ohio, and they brought up this redemption program, and they wanted my opinion of it. So after they expressed it to me, I said, well, it's theft and fraud. First of all, it violates thou shalt not steal in the Ten Commandments. It violates Leviticus 19, 35, and 36, Deuteronomy 25, 13 through 16. I could sit here and cite a number of other biblical laws and statutes that God gave us through Moses that it violates. They were unimpressed. They went to school here. And when they got through with school, they went back home. And 3 out of the 5 were later indicted. One of them was a black man from Philadelphia. I don't remember his name. He was the first Negro real estate broker in Pennsylvania back in the 1960s. Quite a distinction. A very intelligent man, a very wealthy man, a man of means, a man with success behind him. And he bought into this redemption program, and later he was indicted and prosecuted and jailed, went to prison over this redemption program. Now this isn't small potatoes. These people were actually turning out documents on their computers. I don't remember what they were called, whether they were site drafts or something, but they were drawing them on the Department of Transportation. One guy paid off the mortgage of his house. This document went right through the bank. He got a note back from the bank, says your mortgage is canceled. This real estate guy I'm telling you about bought several pieces of real estate, used these site drafts or whatever these documents were called, drawn on the Department of Transportation, and everything went through. Now here's what the Achilles heel is. There's a number that go with these. For instance, let's suppose you work for the Department of Transportation and they've got a multi-billion-dollar-a-year budget. And let's suppose that you're heading up the Department of Transportation agency in San Francisco, California, and you decide one day that you need to buy a new car. Well, you just go down with one of these pieces of paper, and on this piece of paper there's a government number on here. And you write that out and give it to the Ford dealer, and he's going to give you a new Ford Explorer, and you just drive out with it. And it's sold to the government. Anybody that walks in with one of these pieces of paper with this number on it, and somehow or another, these people got this government number, this banker number, whatever it is. And it went right through the bank. Banks paid it. Now here's, this all sounds really good, and the people that got caught up in this, I remember a lady out in, it was up in northern Idaho, Kamei, Idaho. And she was going into the grocery store, and she'd buy $200 or $300 worth of groceries and issue one of these pieces of paper, and she'd walk out, and the grocer loved her. Because these site drafts or these documents would go right through and the bank would pay it and everything went well. But here's your Achilles heel. The Office of Management and Budget goes through all of these documents about, you know, a year or two later, and they audit all of this to see if the Department of Transportation spent their money correctly or wisely or unwisely. And they audited it, and now they've got people that are paying mortgages on their houses in Michigan, buying groceries in Kamei, Idaho, and real estate in Philadelphia. And these documents were never issued by the Department of Transportation. They went through the banks, they had the right numbers on them, and they were all paid, but they weren't issued by the department. So they called in the FBI, and the FBI went out, and they knocked on this lady's door and said, "Lady, you're out here buying groceries. Where'd you get these numbers?" And then she told the FBI agent, you know, all about this redemption program and, you know, receive for value and one thing and another. And, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. And, of course, all these people are ecstatic. See, this has been going on for, by this time, 2 or 3 years. These people they've been spending money up the gazoo and just living life to the full. All right, but now it's redemption time, all right, boys and girls, and it's the government's time to redeem its money. And so they came to these people, indicted them, and prosecuted them, and put them in prison. So just remember this. Anytime a law violates the law of God, it's a criminal activity. If you got a license to engage in this activity, it's just as illegal. It's just that the government gave you permission to get into this illegal activity. All right. Now that was that's the basic story of this redemption. Now here's flaw number one. The birth certificate is not the basis for the creation of credit in this country. Economic texts and a wide variety of other materials plainly demonstrate the manner by which credit or money is created in this country. A bank or central bank like the Federal Reserve extends credit in exchange for the receipt of some note or other financial obligation made by either a private party or government. At the federal level, the Federal Reserve extends credit to the U.S. Treasury simply by bookkeeping entries made in favor of the United States when the Fed buys obligations of the United States. In contrast, a birth certificate is not a note or other debt instrument. Contrary to what Roger Elvick, Ron Nutt, Wally Peterson, or others like Dave DeRimmer may contend, simply stated, a birth certificate is not a note, bond, or other financial obligation. It is not sold to financial institutions, contrary to the blatant lies of the liars, promoters of this argument. In short, the birth certificate is not the foundation for the credit used as money today in this country. Now, the birth certificate has meaning. The birth certificate is a bad document. The birth certificate is a story that we ought to take up one of these days, but it's not the basis of credit. Now, here's another example. You take a legal document, like a birth certificate, and then you create around that this fiction that goes along with it. So you tell the truth about this birth certificate and about how it works and one thing and another, and then you add to that some lies. And the bottom line is that deception comes from truth and error mixed together. Truth and error mixed together. Now, here's flaw number two. The birth certificate cannot be, as a matter of law, a guarantee of debt. A debt is created by a debtor making a promise to pay a creditor a specified amount of money over a specified period of time. Merchandise purchased on credit involves the buyer delivering a promissory note to the seller, wherein he promises to pay a specific periodic amount with interest until the debt is paid. When a borrower obtains a loan, he delivers a promissory note to the lender. A promissory note, by definition, requires the payment of certain specific amounts of funds to the holder of the note. Is a birth certificate a promissory note? It simply cannot be, because the party named therein has no obligation to make any payments of anything to some alleged holder thereof, and traffic tickets, indictments, IRS documents and letters, etc., also are not commercial instruments. Now, traffic tickets are legal documents, indictments, IRS documents, and letters. These are all legal documents that have a place in our society and in our legal system. But then when somebody comes along and takes one of these documents and then spins a yarn and then puts a legal doctrine together and says, if you do A, B, and C, here's going to be the results, and sells that to you for $75, he's just selling you some snake venom and mouse milk. He's not selling you something that's got any real legal merit to it. Now, but ignoring for the moment this major fatal flaw, presume for purposes of argument that a birth certificate is indeed a promissory note. These redemption advocates claim that the straw man is liable to pay some unspecified amount to some unspecified creditor who holds the financial instrument known as a birth certificate. I've been unable to learn from the advocates the name of this ephemeral creditor. They further argue that the counterpart of the straw man, you must answer for this debt of the straw man. This is legally impossible. You ever heard the story of the emperor and his new clothes? These legal arguments are akin to the emperor and his new clothes. When people use legal words and terms that you don't understand, it's time for you to pick up the dictionary or grab your wallet and hang on tight. Something's not right here. Now, the statute of frauds originates from the common law, and every state today has a general statute of frauds. For example, here in Alabama, we have a statute of frauds found in Alabama Code 892, which states that every special promise to answer for a debt, default, or miscarriage of another must be in writing and signed by the party to be charged. This same type of requirement appears in our version of the Uniform Commercial Code in Alabama Code 7-2-201, which requires contracts for the sale of goods of more than $500 to be in writing and subscribed by the party liable. Precisely where is your agreement to answer for the debt of the straw man? If such an agreement exists, have you signed that agreement making you legally liable to pay that debt of the straw man. The truth of the matter is that such a signed agreement doesn't exist, but without your signature to a guarantee making you liable for this debt, you cannot legally be liable. Now, there is a thing here that Larry hasn't pointed out, and I'm going to point it out right here, which is called an adhesion contract. You can have an adhesion contract that binds you to the terms and conditions of a contract that you've never seen, don't know anything about, but you signed up for it. Let me give you an example of an adhesion contract. The warranty card that's in a box. Remember, says warranty rather than guarantee. See, a guarantee is a unilateral promise. It says, I promise that I'll do this and such. A warranty is a bilateral. That's you and somebody else, the manufacturer. An example of that is you buy a toaster over here at Walmart, and in the box there's a warranty card, and the clerk says, be sure to fill out this warranty card. Now, unbeknownst to you, General Electric has put its warranty, its document called warranty, they have written it up, their lawyers wrote it up, and they filed it with the Secretary of State back in Connecticut. They're selling that toaster to you down here in Paris and Arkansas, and you live in Isabella, Missouri. So you're going to buy this thing across state lines. It was made in some manufacturing plant, maybe in New York. This thing is in interstate commerce. And General Motors, or General Electric in this case, wants to protect itself. They want to protect themselves from product liability. So they write up this warranty. And in this warranty, there will be a clause that says, we're not liable for you plugging this thing in and killing yourself. And if you killed yourself plugging this thing into the wall, General Electric limits its liability to replacement or repair of the toaster. Remember, this thing is an adhesion contract. You've never read it. It's on file. It's a legal document. It's a disclaimer. We're not responsible. And it's on file in Connecticut. And you've signed on to it when you signed on to the warranty card. Now, that's called an adhesion contract. You never read the full terms and conditions of the contract, but there is one. But to use the term straw man, as I said before, look it up in the dictionary, a straw man is a professional perjurer. That's the definition of it. The way they're using the word straw man is a vernacular use that has nothing to do with the dictionary definition. And of course, the use of a birth certificate is some kind of a credit instrument. A birth certificate is a legal document, but it doesn't have anything to do with credit. And so they take truth and error, mix it together, and they come up with this bowl of pottage that has no merit. So Beecraft has taken the time to research it out and to list the cases where these people have used these kinds of arguments and have gone to jail. So I'm just here as a reporter to report to you that this information is available. So before you get involved in this straw man UCC redemption program, that you open your eyes and find out what it is that you're actually doing. Like the black real estate broker, from every indication that I have, and I only know the guy from the 2 weeks that he went to school here, but he appeared to be a very honest, straightforward, straight-shooting man who was totally convinced that this redemption process was the greatest thing since sliced white bread. And he told me about birth certificates and he told me about all these things. He had words that I'd never heard before. Now, I teach law, and I'm pretty familiar with legal terms, but, you know, when people start using three or four-syllable words and they start speaking in foreign languages like Latin, using legal terms, I get real nervous. I go, gee, you know, you're talking way over my head. I don't understand that. It's what I call the Emperor's New Clothes Syndrome. And you can be very sincere, very honest and straightforward person, who, honest to God, you really believe every word that these people have told you. But that isn't going to keep you out of the penitentiary. When you break the law, you get prosecuted, it's going to look very bad for you. I'm just telling you, from my own personal experience. So the advocates of this insanity, now that's Larry Becraft's word, not mine. The advocates of this insanity further contend that the international banks which hold these birth certificates as security for some unknown financial obligation have a claim against you for your whole life unless, of course, you redeem your straw man by perfecting your claim against him by filing a Form UCC-1 financing statement. Now, can you really be legally responsible for some debt for the rest of your life? Again, our statute of frauds found at Alabama Code 8-9-2 requires that every agreement which by its terms is not to be performed within 1 year from the making thereof must be in writing and signed by the party to be charged. The redemptionists assert that whenever a child is born and his birth certificate is filed in the District of Columbia and later bought by some big bank, that creditor owns you for the rest of your life. We all know that the average life expectancy of a baby is longer than a single year. Just where is this agreement signed by you, apparently on the day that you were born or by your parents, which cannot by its very terms be performed within a single year? Have you ever signed such an agreement? The truth of the matter is that every aspect of this redemption theory flies in the face of the statute of frauds. And flaw number three. Our bodies and our labor are not articles of commerce. Flaw number four. The 1935 Social Security Act did not create an account for everyone born in this country in the amount of $630,000. Now, I want to interject here that the Social Security account number is a bad program. And when you signed up for Social Security, you got yourself involved in a legal process that's ultimately going to be bad for you. It's prohibited in the scripture. God warned you about it. He told you not to get involved in it. Don't do that. But of course, we at this juncture of time don't have much to say about it. Our parents typically get these for us. I went down and got my own when I was age 12. Then when I found out about it, I rescinded mine in 1978. Now, you can rescind Social Security, but the above-named flaw number five account is not the Treasury Direct account. That's the word I was looking for. These people were filling out documents that said Treasury Direct account on it. That's what it was. And then there's a sixth flaw. You cannot write site drafts on the Treasury of the United States by way of this non-existent account. And that's what these people were doing. They have non-existent accounts in which they're writing these Treasury Direct documents on. Now, I'm telling you, boys and girls, we'll have to break off here. When we come back, I'll cover these last three or four arguments in our last segment here of Destroyed Arguments by Larry Becraft. But, you know, Becraft hit the nail right on the head, and he's got the documents and the cases that where people have already tested and tried this. So, again, let me give you a word of warning. It's already been tested. It's already been tried. I personally know of three people that have gone to prison, and Becraft has cited a number of cases where others have gone to prison, and this isn't something new. It goes back 5 years. Becraft's article, now remember, it's called Destroyed Arguments, and you can get a copy of it off the web, fly.highway.net. That's Larry Becraft's webpage. It's fly.highway. This highway is spelled HIWAAY.net. All right, there's the plug for Larry Becraft. We'll take up this redemption thing again. We'll finish that story next time here on the Law Hour tomorrow night. Now, you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard worldwide here in the United States, or heard worldwide over the Internet and here in the United States 7 days a week. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night with the concluding chapter tomorrow. Thanks for listening, and until then, good night, friends.